see. I think we read a little bit of chapter 7, and we decided that we would talk about or read it again and then talk about it.
Okay, let's read it again. You want to read it again? We'll just... Oh, Father, thank you for our time together today. I thank you for my brother Dave and our long association, and I pray, Father, that you'd open up the Bible and give him understanding, give us both understanding of what you're talking about here, that we can understand it in the context of the culture in the first century, but also for now. So, in the name of Jesus.
Amen. 1 Corinthians chapter 7.
Verse 20.
Now, great Scott. Oh.
So Howard didn't make it yet, huh?
He's going to be late. Okay. What size shoes are you, Dwayne?
Okay, 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife of her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment. For I wish that all men were even as I myself. But each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it is good for them if they remain even as I am, but if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband, but even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And a husband is not to divorce his wife. But to the rest, I, not the Lord, say, if another brother has a wife who does not believe, and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. But if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or a sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. For how do I know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? But as God has distributed to each one, as the Lord has called each one, so let him walk. And so I ordain in all the churches. Was anyone called while circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Was anyone called while uncircumcised? Let him not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing, but keeping the commandments of God is what matters. Let each one remain in the same calling in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Do not be concerned about it. But if you can be made free, rather use it. For he who is called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who is called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price. Do not become slaves of men. Brethren, let each one remain with God in that state in which he was called. Now concerning virgins, I have no commandment from the Lord. Yet I give judgment as one whom the Lord in his mercy has made trustworthy. I suppose, therefore, that is good because of the present distress. That it is good for a man to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be loosed. Are you loosed from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But even if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. Nevertheless, such will have trouble in the flesh, but I would spare you. But this I say, brethren, the time is short, so that from now on, even those who have wives should be as though they had none. Those who weep as though they did not weep, those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use the world as not misusing it. For the form of this world is passing away, but I want you to be without care. He who is unmarried cares for the things of the world, of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. There is a difference between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman cares about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy, both in body and in spirit. But she who is married cares about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And this I say for your own profit, not that I may put a leash on you, but for what is proper, and that you may serve the Lord without distraction. But if any man thinks he is behaving improperly towards his virgin, if she is past the flower of youth, and thus it must be, let him do what he wishes. He does not sin. Let them marry. Nevertheless, he who stands steadfast in his heart, having no necessity, but has power over his own will, and has so determined in his heart that he will keep his virgin, does well. So then he who gives her in marriage does well, but he who does not give her in marriage does better. A wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives, but if her husband dies, she is at liberty to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. But she is happier if she remains as she is. According to my judgment, I think I also have the Spirit of God.
Thank you. Okay, I mentioned that there were four subjects here. The first one is married life. The next one here is separation, and then after that, divorce, or the possibility of divorce, and then finally, a single life. So we got four items.
All in chapter 7, right?
Yeah, okay. Now, in chapter 7, he begins by saying it's a good, it is well for a man not to touch a woman. Now, that means have intercourse with him. It doesn't mean to give her a hug or hold hands. It's not about holding hands or being affectionate or being, it's about this boundary of temptation where you go so far and then you can't avoid. Next thing you know, you're in bed. So that's what he's talking about. It's great if you're not hung up on your girlfriend. That's because when you really fall in love and you get, sometimes you get totally captured by that. And he says it's, so he's talking here to men who are not married, and he just says, you're doing great. Don't get all hung up on women and marriage. And in our culture, you know, the kids get involved in sex at 11 or 12 or 13 and pornography and sleeping around. And the culture is very, very broken. As it couldn't hardly be any more broken, except Christians have to live a different kind of lifestyle. Okay.
Otherwise, it becomes a train wreck. I mean, that's
a bottom line. A train wreck is exactly the right
wreck any other way.
Yeah, okay. All right. Now, because of the temptation to immorality, each of you should have his own wife, and each man, then, should have his own wife, and each woman, her husband. So, most men have a hard time managing their sexual drive. Most men are going to behave themselves if they have regular intercourse with their wives, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. That's normal, natural for a married person. So, he's actually talking in favor of marriage. If you are lonely and you need the reinforcement that a good wife brings and you need the regular sexual release, then marriage is what God's designed for you. Okay? Since Adam and Eve. Okay. So he says in marriage, the husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. So if you are married, he's saying, pay attention to the fact that your wife needs affection and that sexual intercourse should be a normal part of your marriage. I've never been married, so I don't know anything about that. But he's obviously not negative about sex at all in the right context. So he says, if you're married, go for it. But in the good marriages, that Ray talks about this, in a good marriage, the wife is paying attention to her husband's needs, that he's all uptight and he's all horny and everything. And so she's going to love him and help him and encourage him. That's the, and vice versa. The woman needs love and affection and affirmation. And that's going to, if you end up in bed, have sex every day, that's fine. It's something private that married couples decide if they're having a good marriage. It's not for the outsiders to pry into, because it's secret of the marriage bed, okay? So he says, don't refuse one another. In other words, if you're used to regular sex and you're married, don't shut off your wife, and wife, don't shut off your husband. In other words, the sexual relationships that you have are normal and natural, and they please God, and that's all fine. If you're married, adjust, both of you should adjust to the needs of the other, and there's a lot of getting used to intimacy with your wife that I don't know anything about, but I've heard tell. Okay? So he says, if for any reason you feel like you're going to go on a fast, or you're going to abstain for some reason or another, be careful about your partner, that you don't drive her up the wall by being unavailable, by not showing her the affection and the love that she wants. And likewise, if she won't give you sex and you're married, then this could easily frustrate the man who's used to regular sex, right? Okay. So he says, there may be times in your marriage when you want to get off separately, get apart, and it's perfectly okay if the man goes off on a retreat or the woman goes to visit her mother and you don't have the usual conjugal relationships, then pray about it, because you're one flesh, you're married. So that's the argument here. So in other words, don't cheat on your wife. Now, today, most everybody cheats, or a lot of people do. The marriage isn't working, so after a while, the wife will get a friend and not tell the husband, or the husband will fool around outside of marriage, which immediately it violates the integrity of the marriage. So he's just saying, look, the holy matrimony is what we call it, so, and it is holy. And so I just wish I had known a few more, I wish I knew a few more happily married Christian couples. I just meet very few. And once I get to know a lot of professing Christians, I find that their marriage is not fulfilling at all, that they're living in the same house, but that they're at odds with each other, the communication is broken down. And that will show up in the bedroom. And the other situation would be that the wife feels that her husband is forcing himself on her, and vice versa. So you don't want to put demands on your partner, but you want to find the common ground that suits you, okay? That's all I know about marriage.
Can I make a quick comment?
Please,
so,
yeah.
You know, I mean, there's like a wide range of different kinds of baggage that people carry with them,
yeah,
you know?
In marriage, yeah.
Because of the situation they were born in and the kind of experience
this is just
they had
huge.
Early part of their life.
Yeah.
And as a result, you know, like it's not like one size fits all, or like one
exactly,
you know, one set of rules is going to work for everybody, because depending on what the baggage is,
and temperament and all that, yes.
Yep. And if you don't, because of that, if you don't have if you don't take a sacrificial approach to the relationship, in other
that's
words,
good.
Be willing for the, you know, I mean, Jesus kind of laid it all out. He's starting with, you know, he said, put the, you know, put God first and put the other person or all other people before yourself. So yeah. There's a sacrificial element.
That's good, yeah. Thing.
And the idea is that, you know, there's complex things going on in each person. And that's another reason why, you know, also this whole thing with pornography and everything where you're objectifying the other person.
Yeah.
You know, it really detracts from the reality of what that person and who that person is, you know. They're not just an object to be lusted over. They're a real person with, you know, with real issues and real...
hopefully you're going to be more intimate.
Real commonalities and also real differences. So that there's going to be, there's going to be both between the two people, whoever they are, you know, that come together in marriage.
That's good. I like that. Help, Dave, that all makes sense. Okay. Now, he notices here in verse 7, I wish that all were as I am myself. But each has his own special gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. Paul is single when he wrote traveled around and wrote the New Testament, but many people think he was married earlier in his life, when he was in the Sanhedrin, when he was Jewish. We don't know a thing. There's not a hint in the Bible or in history or any place that talks about his wife. So did she die, or did she leave him when he went crazy and followed Jesus? We don't know. But at this time in his life, he says, I'm really very happy being a single man out on the battlefront, getting in trouble constantly. What wife would ever put up with that? And even in today's age when you can send email back and forth to your wife, she's still at home worrying, and she's still got the kids to raise, and here you are, you're supposed to be the breadwinner, and you're supposed to be comforting her and loving her, and here you are out locked up in some prison someplace, or you got whipped badly or stoned, and good heavens, what wife that breaks the heart of any wife? So he says, I'm really happy with the calling I have, because life is short and I can serve the Lord. And so I wish all of you guys saw the world as I'm seeing it. And we've already talked about how this guy was courageous to the point of being crazy, you know, almost. Okay?
It's interesting that he's saying, you know, he's very specifies in there that, you know, I'm telling you, you know, what my wisdom is. This is not. You know, I'm not proclaiming part of what
this
I'm saying.
This is not doctrine.
It's the Word of God.
That's right.
But, you know, it's pretty simple, I think, what he's saying. He's just saying, look, you know, if you just consider the kind of calling that Paul had, you know, I mean, it was huge. It was tremendous. It was, it was a rough ride. It involved seriously dangerous stuff. And
eventually got his head cut off.
Totally experienced death or came doggone close to it a number of times.
And he ended up dead.
And he ultimately ended up dead, right. So, you know, all of those things aren't the kind of thing that, you know, the average woman would sign up for. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
So it's like, to me, it's like he's saying, you know, if you're gonna serve the Lord in that manner, then, life is a lot simpler, and you're a lot freer to be able to put your all into that calling, if you're not, in a relationship that's going to have all kinds of distractions involved in it.
Exactly. I know.
He's just talking about practicalities here, I think. You know.
I know some women that have forsaken marriage and childbearing to serve the Lord on the mission field, like in Taiwan, and there's what PBC still has a missionary or two that are single women, and the leaders of Stonecroft, the Christian Women's Clubs, were Mrs. Ball was a widow, and her partner was never married, so she was a businesswoman, and so it's in a way for a woman to serve the Lord sacrificially and be single is a bigger price than most men pay. because we don't mind bachelor living, and but women are, have to give up having children, which is very special to them, or making a nice home. They can't go tromping through the jungle every day. Most of them can. Elizabeth, what was it? I forget her name, but she's been to PBC a few times. She was in with the Alka Indians in South America, and the Alka Indians came in one day. They were wild Indians and killed all the husbands, and the widows all.
Now, was she part of the group that Elliot?
Elizabeth Elliot, yeah.
Yeah.
So she was a widow as a very young woman, and she right. came home, and she said, "Well, I'm never going to marry again." She married, however, a very fine man who got cancer and died on her. And she'd been through hell and back twice now. And she was great at speaking and sharing and teaching. And
all those kind of gifts.
Right? Yeah, so she had all those gifts. It's very hard for a woman, if she's been married, to stay with a widow. Now, that comes up a little later. Okay? Now, he's talking about marriage. Next, in verse 10, is this too fast?
No.
In verse 10, he says to the married, "I give charge, not I, but the Lord." Now, this time he's back on a different authority basis. This is not my personal opinion this time. This is what God wants. The wife should not separate from her husband. If she does, let her remain single or else be reconciled to her husband. The husband should not divorce his wife. So that is, for this day and age, that is incredible. And it's from the Lord. This is what God wants. So he recognizes here that some marriages are going to be very difficult for one reason or another. There's going to be a huge amount of incompatibility in some marriages. And it's going to be impossible. You've got a man and a woman who have no common ground, no basis for loving and trusting each other, and yet they're obligated to stay married, they believe. But it gets to the point where this poor woman, in this example here, has got to separate. Is that okay? Yes, it is. But she's not free to remarry. She's perfectly, if she can't stand this son of a bitch husband, she's free to go get her own place and just leave him alone with his lust or job or whatever it is.
Well, oftentimes it's the issue of, her physical safety.
Exactly,
it's necessary to separate just
for
to
her battered
protect
wife.
Yourself. You know,
battered wife syndrome. Where
there's some
the husband
toxic
is
stuff going on
well,
yeah.
beat his wife and kick at her and threaten her life and in some cases kill her. So, yeah. So she's trying very hard to love him and be patient. And women have oftentimes a great deal more endurance than we ever would, because they're going to hang with, I've got a terrible marriage, but I just feel I promised God that I would love this man, and he is so unlovable, and I just can't stand it because he beats me all the time. So what would you say to this woman? Well, get out of that house now, okay? But don't say, she's not told to go find another man, to get a divorce, have a settlement, and go marry again. Now, I know an awful lot of the people I know are married the second time. They have gotten a divorce, right or wrong, for whatever reason, and they have remarried and sought the Lord and have good relationships. But Jesus talked about this. He says, because of your weaknesses, Moses permitted divorce. And so Jesus is saying, look, sometimes divorce is unavoidable. And that's not the end of your life. If you're a divorced person, you can start over again fresh. And that's so. But, in the law of Moses, divorce was not allowed. Okay?
If there's one spouse that doesn't, that wants divorce, hell-bent on it, and the other person
exactly.
doesn't want the divorce.
Yeah.
Bottom line is, you can't control the other person.
No, you can't.
If the person's going to do it, there's probably not a whole lot you can do about it other than to pray about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's right.
As long as there's hope. But once the papers are signed, then it's pretty much a done deal.
Yeah.
And then it's up to the Lord how the rest of it
plays out. Yeah, the divorce is going to be a ripping apart of a man and a woman who become one flesh. So that you get it's going to be emotional agony, and it's going to be painful, and it's going to be major surgery. Dave, you wanted to say something, or talk?
Yeah, I was just wondering here, you know, it says if they are married, let them not divorce. But here in 15, it says, but if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or a sister is not under bondage. Is bondage marriage?
No.
Bondage, I think it's just referring to the covenant, the marriage covenant.
The state of affairs is that.
Which is not a negative bondage.
A Christian should not marry a non-Christian, let's say.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, because I said do not let them divorce, but it was they can divorce but not get remarried.
Well, that's true. That's in there, but it's also if you can avoid the divorce if possible. But now one partner is a Christian and the other one is not. So the husband is not a Christian or the wife is not a Christian, and you didn't know that because when you were dating, you talked about the Lord, and your partner said, oh, yes, I'm a Christian, I was baptized, or whatever. And then after you've lived together a while, you say, boy, she says, this man is a real jerk. He told me he knew God, and he's drinking and smoking and getting stoned and dating other women. And I wanted a man that loved me, and I wanted a marriage, and I wanted God in our marriage. And that's not possible until this guy comes to the Lord.
And there's a real good case that you can make for why it's really good to take your time, get to know the person, and get to actually see how they live their life to the point where you can tell
pretty sure
for certain that the person is a serious Christian or not.
This is what the marriage counselor,
tie the knot.
Yeah, the guy that's going to marry you, it's his responsibility to get to know you and your wife to be and get to know you as people. And then he could say, wow, you guys are going to have a great marriage together.
Good point, yeah.
Which I think would, your case, okay?
So in this case where, the Christian female marries a non-Christian because she kind of acted irrationally, and he turns out to be a real dud, and she does divorce him, is she not able to remarry?
I think most pastors today would say yes, but would say
as long as she had biblical grounds to divorce.
Yeah,
right?
If he was in committing adultery, for example.
Right. So what I was about to point to is in chapter 5 of Matthew, adultery in the heart. If this guy is out there thinking about going on some dating site and he starts going out and dating other women, but not actually fornicating with them. Then that's adultery of the heart, and
it's a form of adultery.
It is, yes, you're right.
Grounds for divorce.
Yeah. Now, what would happen would be if this wife was a good Christian woman, she would spot that because their relationships would not be intimate and open like they should be, and with her intuition, she'll say something is wrong here, and that will go on for a long time before she finds out that he's been fooling around. But she'll pick it up. Mm-hmm. Now, this passage here says, if there is one Christian in this marriage, that allows God to take care of the kids. The whole marriage is considered sanctified, even if one partner's not a believer. There's a lot of people like that in church. I can name a few almost right off the top of my head that are just that. One woman I know, years and years ago, wanted to divorce her husband, and everybody said no, and hang in there. And finally, her husband has came around, and he's a great Christian man now, but she won him by her love and her patience. She got him converted, essentially. He was apathetic and indifferent to the Lord when I met him, but not now.
Yeah.
Now, that's not always going to happen, because one partner can be very stubborn. I think this mostly applies to the man, because women are more generally open to the Lord when a man really loves them. I don't think they're not as wild and carefree as men. Did you think so? Maybe.
I've met some that are the other extreme, so I think there's exceptions. That's probably the rule, what you're saying, but there are exceptions out there, too, and I've met some of them.
So in that case that you just spoke of, it talks about that in 1 Peter 3:1 through about 6. Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even some do not who obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives. When they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear, do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging your hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God.
That's good. That's wonderful. This is saying to the wife, look, don't get a bunch of skimpy clothes and don't dress like a whore, because that just sends oceans of information to your husband about lust and about your selfishness and so on. In other words, be a beautiful woman to this man and love him and be patient with him. And that's what's right here, what Paul says.
You're supposed to do everything you can in the situation where, you know, let's say it starts out where there a separation is necessary.
Yeah.
Even if the person, you know, who's maybe the victim in the situation, has biblical grounds for divorce, it's pretty clear in Scripture, I think, that God's heart is not to pursue that.
Yeah.
Until you have done everything you can to try to reconcile the situation with the relationship with the other spouse. And make a reasonable effort at that before you just rush off and
take and
do the divorce thing. I talked to our brother Howard about that, when he was going through it, and his emotions were running so high, unfortunately, that he just plowed on through on the divorce. But I think he's starting to understand that was probably not the best thing to do.
Yeah,
from some of my more recent conversations.
Oftentimes, a couple in the church will be willing to talk to a pastor or to a wiser person. Oftentimes, the wise person might be an older woman who's a widow, and very, very godly, Elaine Stedman type person, and that get that third party involved, who can ask questions of both parties, and find out which one knows the Lord if it isn't already clear, and get these two to be patient. And now the whole key part here is, if you're in such a marriage where one is not a marriage is not a believer, nevertheless, the believing partner sanctifies the whole marriage. So the whole marriage is honorable, and the kids have God's protection. And the women, say in this case, can spend time with the kids, can lead them to the Lord, can nurture them, can homeschool them, whatever she wants. I can think of one marriage that's not very functional, where the wife homeschools the kids and pours love into their hearts, and the husband is not a believer, but he doesn't interfere. So it's love that wins anybody to the Lord, and that's it's very, very hard to love somebody when you've been hurt so much, and you've been the communication is all how to say okay.
One other quick thing is that unequally yoked situations, it's not always the case that, one person was a believer, the other wasn't, and the believer, made a poor choice to go ahead and marry. That's one way it happens.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the majority of the time. But there's also a timing issue that really nobody's really to blame, because if the two people were not believers when they got married, then, who's counseling them? Probably nobody. And, what do they know about making godly decisions in that situation? So, if they're both unbelievers when they get married, then, one of them comes to the Lord.
Then the other one
the unequally yoked thing there, and it wasn't because of any poor judgment on anybody's part. It was just the timing of when things happened.
Many people become Christians after they're married.
Yeah.
Maybe they've been married for 5-10 years and they say, hey, let's start a Bible study here in our home, or let's go to a different church, or and the other partner says, well, okay, let's do it. And next thing you know, they both know Jesus, and now their marriage has really got some electricity in it.
That's kind of Lee Strobel's story,
him
and his
right?
wife. And there's a movie out that just came out recently called The Case for Christ, but this time it's the story, a dramatization of the story of, you know, her coming to Christ first, and then because of that, you know, that's basically what ultimately motivated him to pursue investigating Christianity, mm-hmm. and the case for Christianity, and as well as the case against Christianity, to try to weigh it all out, and then that ultimately brought him to faith.
So Lambert, I guess you'll need dinner tonight, right?
No dinner, I think. Howard's supposed to show up with our.
Okay.
But he might not.
All right.
Thank you. Look at what it says in verse 15. If the unbelieving partner desires to separate, let it be so. In such a case, the brother or sister is not bound, for God has called us to peace. So if you're going to have a separation because you're so incompatible, it doesn't cause the marriage to be broken or the children to be outside of God's love. Then this part, verse, God has called us to peace. Wife, how do you know whether you will save your husband? Husband, how do you know whether you will save your wife?
Yep.
And that often happens, oftentimes, that the love and patience of the believer eventually wins the unbeliever, work either way, you can say, God gave me this marriage, and boy, I didn't realize what I was getting in for because of all the baggage that my wife brought along with her, and her mother's living with us, and it's just been very difficult. But I love this woman, and she loves me, and we're gonna thresh this out, and we are praying together, and you know, God answers prayers like that because He wants the marriage to be fulfilling. Okay.
Yep.
All right, now let's look a little more at it. Let's go on. Verse 17. Is this okay?
It's great.
Only let everyone lead the life which the Lord has assigned to him and in which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. Some people feel that they have to get married and they probably should get married. And other people say, I'm perfectly happy being single. I'm certainly happy being single. And either being single or being married, they both have equal weight with God. The marriage is not superior to being single. Apostle Paul was single. So if you could be, the main thing about that is your time and energy are available to the Lord. And so you don't have to worry about, the fact is that if you're married, you've got to, take care of a house, you've got to pay the mortgage, you've got to buy the groceries. If you're raising kids, they take an enormous amount of time, and they got to have new clothes and bicycles and toys, and they want quality time with their parents. And if you're working hard, and maybe even your wife is working hard too, you don't have a lot of time left over for the kids. So this is where...
Resources too.
Yeah, resources. You don't have enough money. So what... Somebody says, oh, I want you to go on a trip. I'm going to India tomorrow for 2 weeks. There's room if you want to come with me. And the guy says, oh, I'd love to go with you, but I can't. Well, he can't because he's...
It's realistic.
Now, the marriage should overflow into the community. It should overflow into the kids. The neighbors should say, boy, I'm going to go talk to the people next door because I know they've got a good marriage and we're struggling, say. So marriage is something that God uses when you get a good marriage. It overflows to everybody involved. If you're single, your life should overflow to everybody. So, okay? Verse. This is why he says, everyone should remain in the state in which he was called. Were you a slave when called? Never mind. If you can gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. For he who is called in the Lord as a slave is a freedman of the Lord. Likewise, he who is free when called is a slave of Christ. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. So, brothers, in whatever state each was called, let him remain with God. In the Roman Empire, about 50 or 60% of the people were slaves. And in other words, over half. And that means they can be bought and sold at a slave market. And if you own some slaves, you are obligated to take care of them and treat them fairly. Slave owners oftentimes were harsh and cruel. You could kill your slave if he messed up. So slavery was not fun unless you had a good slave master. Now, a slave becomes a Christian. Should he do everything he can to get out of his position in society as a slave? No. Not ordinarily. If you can get out of slavery and become a free man, do it. American slavery was pretty bad because black slaves were bought and traded on the slave market, and they were beaten and whipped and treated. And the slaves lived in poverty, usually separate from the main house.
And before that, that was being done by the Europeans to the American Indians,
yeah,
even before the Pilgrims.
Absolutely
arrived.
Right. So the fact is that we have chosen to be slaves of Jesus. That means bond slaves. It means under rowers. It means servants of Jesus. That's the only thing we can be with Jesus running the universe and him being such a powerful, wonderful man. It's a pleasure to serve Jesus. It's absolutely a delight, especially when you see people's lives changed because of your influence, and you see how many people love you and say nice things about you because you're single. You say, wow, this is a great life. And the freedom to travel around, which I've enjoyed. Before I became a Christian, I sort of prayed, I prayed that I could see some foreign countries. And now I have seen Australia twice and Japan twice and the Philippines 3-4 times and Alaska about 6 times. And I've been to England and to Scotland and to Denmark and to Germany and to Egypt and to Israel and to Jordan without paying a single nickel out of my own pocket.
Wow.
Not a single. And so God heard me and answered that, and I can look back and I'm overwhelmed now to realize how many different nations I visited. I remember speaking at a military base in Germany with Ted Wise and how awesome it was. And I remember speaking at a South India to the schools, the Christian schools down there, how awesome it was. And how, when you see another culture and you meet Christians in another culture, maybe in Mexico, I've been to Mexico City several times, and spoken in the prisons there and so on. And that's all because I could hop on a plane and go. And I've got the freedom to go and I don't have to worry about a wife left back home. But I'm actually blown away to look back and realize that God did this for me, because seeing other people, particularly Christians in other lands, is mind-blowing. Particularly when you see the poor Christians in India or the poor Christians in the Philippines that have nothing. And yet they invite you to stay in their home and they show you hospitality or they'll kill a favorite sheep, whatever it takes to, I don't know how many kids, I can think of 2 or 3 times when I've been in families that where the daughter or the son gave up their bedroom for me and they'd sleep in the floor, which is, I'd rather sleep on the floor, but that's the hospitality is that. Anyway, so he's thinking about the slavery in the Roman Empire where half of the people are slaves, and he's telling the masters, look, and this happens in the case of Onesimus, that Paul met this poor, there was a runaway slave who found Paul in prison in Rome, and Paul realized that this was illegal to run away from your masters. If you ran away from your master, you could be punished by the law. If you were restored to your master, he could kill you or penalize you severely, and oftentimes when the slave ran away, he'd hit the family jewelry, and because he lives in a wealthy family, say, and so this slave is a criminal fleeing from his rightful owner. So Paul writes this fantastic letter in the New Testament where he writes to the slave owner whom he knows, and he says,
Philemon.
We should read that letter, but it's
Philemon.
Philemon. Philemon. Anyway,
yep.
Paul writes this compassionate letter to the owner of this slave, and he says, I'm sending this runaway slave back to you, and he's no longer just a slave, he's your Christian brother, because this slave has become a Christian, and now you got two Christians. You got Philemon and Onesimus, and they have got to be brothers in Christ. So Philemon can't, he's got to talk about, he's got to have a good talk with Onesimus about, did you steal anything from me? And Onesimus has to say, well, I did take this and this and this, and here they are. Or, no, I didn't, but why were you unhappy with me? Was I treating you poorly? No, I just wanted to be free. And so this slave and this master have got to be Christian brothers living in the same house. And the slave may very well keep his old job, but it's going to be a totally different relationship between slave owner and slave. Because they're brothers in Christ, and you wouldn't think of taking another Christian brother and ordering him around and whipping him and beating him. He's your brother. Now, the interesting thing about Philemon, it seems... Hello!
If I'm too late, I'll just leave.
Philemon probably becomes the pastor of the church in some place, Laodicea, I think it was. And Philemon shows up in the literature from some later years. He became the bishop of Ephesus. And he became a pastor, and he rose to the position of the highest authority of the church of Ephesus. We have some letters. One of his fellow bishops, I think from Antioch, had been busted by the Romans, and he was on his way to Rome to be executed or to be thrown in the arena with lions and torn apart. He was on the way to martyrdom. And I think there was mail back and forth and he mentions that the bishop of Ephesus showed him hospitality. And that was... Also, we think that Onesimus is the first person who put the books of the New Testament together into an ensemble and saved them.
Wow.
So this slave did pretty well.
Played a significant role there.
So this is what God does with people when they're downtrodden and slaves to sin and the scum of the earth. And this is where God reaches, just to us, down to us three. Okay? Anyway, 25. Now concerning the unmarried, so he's going to talk to us single men here, because they might get married soon, we hope so, but in the meantime he's a single brother. Concerning the unmarried, I have no command of the Lord. So I want to just give you my personal opinion. This is not from God, right? Concerning the unmarried, I have no command of the Lord, but I give my opinion as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. So, Paul, again, he's so revealing about himself, because his whole life's desire is to please Jesus, and he doesn't much care what people think of him. He doesn't care how he's treated. The whole bottom line is he wants God to be happy with his lifestyle.
Amen.
Now, he does say, I think that in view of the impending distress, it is well for a person to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be free. Are you free from a wife? Do not seek marriage. Now, that's pretty... So, if you are married, don't get a divorce or leave your wife on the grounds that you've got to go fight in the battles of the Lord that are going on because the culture is collapsing, or there's a war on, or there's total chaos in the culture. And some people would use that as an excuse to get free from marriage. Don't. And he says the same with if you're tempted with pornography all the time, if you can't stop looking at girls and you're climbing up the wall with lust. Go ahead and get married, because that's the normal, natural way. So he says, but don't seek a wife. He says, don't go out of your way, because there's no panacea. Because whether you're single or whether you're married, it's Jesus that's going to be the one that meets your needs. So either. So he's saying marriage is fine, being single is fine, whichever. Okay? If you marry, you don't sin. If a girl marries, she does not sin. Yet those who marry will have worldly troubles, and I would spare you that. So we talked about the worldly troubles. Paying the rent.
Way more complex inside of a marriage relationship.
Oh.
Way more complex.
Oh, infinitely.
Hard work.
Yeah. And that can be very exciting. I think with Dave's going to have a very exciting marriage. I think it's that's what lies ahead for him, but nobody knows except God.
Right, I'm sorry I'm late, you guys. I mean,
no, we got the word.
You have a lot of traffic and everything. You know, I'll just leave. You know, if you want me to, but I'm hungry right now too. I gotta go get the sandwich.
Yeah.
All right, I'm gonna go get my sandwiches out of my car.
Yeah, I've been waiting for my sandwich.
Right.
Poor old Howard. He can do another makeup.
Sounds like he's had a busy day today.
Good old Howard. I mean, brothers, the appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none, and those who mourn as though they were not mourning, and those who rejoice as though they were not rejoicing, and those who buy as though they had no goods.
It's your phone.
Hello.
Hi, Lambert.
Hi. And those who buy as though they had no goods, and those who deal with the world as they had no dealings with it, for the form of this world is passing away. So the world is an evil place. We live in an unfriendly environment. We're hated by the world. We're marginalized by the world. We could get killed by the world. So this is a combat zone. So there's no way you can live happily ever after in an evil world, a fallen world system. So that's what he's saying. Whether you're single or whether you're married, stay alert. Live frugally and carefully and be on guard. And there are times of great crisis come upon any culture that would be maybe we're going to go through an earthquake. Maybe we're going to have a war with Russia. Maybe we're going to get nuked. We don't know. God knows. But he's protecting us anyway. Yeah. Hey, Howard. I want you to be free from anxieties. The unmarried man is anxious about the affairs of the Lord, how to please the Lord. But the married man is anxious about worldly affairs. How to please his wife, and his interests are divided. So, the married person and his family. Oh, what a nice man you are.
There's a bunch of beef sandwiches, roast beef or tuna if you want them. They're right there. Okay.
So, the single person does not have to, should not get himself all involved in an expensive house or like I did. Hi, Howard.
Hi, how you doing?
Good to see you. That you got delayed, but that's
I'm sorry,
okay.
I was late, and then there's a lot of traffic.
Verse 32. If anyone thinks that he is behaving properly, that he's not behaving properly towards his betrothed, that would be his, the person he's engaged to, if his passions are strong, and it has to be, let him do as he wishes. If you want to get married, go ahead, get married. There's nothing wrong with that. It's no sin. But whoever is firmly established in his heart, being under no necessity, but having his desire under control, in other words, his hormones aren't all raging and driving him up the wall, and he is determined in his heart to keep her as his betrothed, he does well. That's kind of difficult. I don't know what he's saying here. So he who marries his betrothed does well. He who refrains from marriage will do better. And that's kind of complicated because you leave this poor girl waiting in the wings and heartbroken because she wants to marry you and you won't marry her. I don't think that's... A wife is bound to her husband as long as he lives, If the husband dies, she's free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. But in my judgment, she's happier if she remains as she is. And I think that I have the Spirit of God. There are many situations where there will be a very happy, fulfilling marriage and the husband will die. In fact, women are healthier and they live longer than men ordinarily. So it's very, very common to have widows in the church.
Because yeah, so we wear neckties. That's what I'm raised him because we wear neckties.
Yeah, we wear, yeah, that's how you tell. Because men have to wear neckties and they're very constraining.
Yeah. I was just thinking from what you were reading there that, you know, a big issue that we talked about this before, I guess, but I think it's worth repeating maybe, is the issue of unrealistic expectations on both the part of the man and the woman.
Yep.
Because the culture sets us up that way, you know, conditions us that way. And, you know, that's a for sure recipe for a train wreck.
It is.
And I think one of the most important things that premarital counseling can do is to eliminate as many of expose and then eliminate as many of those unrealistic expectations as possible, because those are just train wreck disasters waiting to happen if they're not dealt with, you know, before the knot gets tied, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, the more realistic the two people are when they're going into the relationship, the better the odds are that the relationship is going to thrive and survive. But if those things aren't dealt with, just the opposite is true.
I was thinking about in the marriage vow where it says, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. And those are pretty horrendous things, because your wife may get cancer, she may have stillborn baby, bringing children in the world is very, very painful, I'm told. And then your husband dies. I know a woman at PBC whose husband was killed in a mining accident in Colorado when she was probably in her 20s.
Wow.
And that woman raised two boys and I remember I used to take her boys hiking up at New Albany Mine, and she'd worried to death, of course, but I wasn't going to let anything happen to them. But she's a dear friend to this day. I think she's in her 90s. And she's never tried to remarry again. Very godly, wonderful, wonderful, loving, hospitable woman. I think of Mary Lou Rowe. You may know Mary Lou Rowe. Bob Rowe was an elder.
I've heard quite a bit about him. Part of the reason is because I took that class from Lynn Fox, who was a great friend of Bob Rowe.
Bob Rowe was, you know,
he's mentioned in the book too as one of the major inspirations for her writing that book.
I was I got to speak from the pulpit at PBC once, and I chose Isaiah 58, Peter, get off the ladder, and I had two morning services, and Bob Rowe and Mary Lou came to that one of those services. And I didn't know whether he liked it or not, whether I was doing a good job or not. But you know what he said to me as I was at the end of the message? Lambert, you are my very favorite Bible teacher at PBC. Bob Rowe. And he could run circles around me. And that's the most wonderful compliment I've ever had. And he died not too long after that. And Mary Lou is still a dear friend. Mary Lou Rowe, do you know Mary Lou?
No.
Oh, she's pretty old now, but
pretty insightful. I mean, look what you've been doing for how many years now?
Yes, but I don't consider. I consider myself.
You are the advanced Bible study teacher. So.
That's you're blowing me out of the water. Because I don't think I am. Okay, we just did chapter 7, Howard.
Okay.
And we got to spend some. We probably time to have some sharing and pray. And I tell you what.
So you did cover the fact that if a person does die within the marriage, that person can remarry.
Yes, but only in the Lord. That means
to another Christian.
To another Christian, and then it says, "In my judgment, she, the widow, usually is a widow, because the men don't live very long because we're so fragile, and we get ourselves in trouble out on the battlefront. So, in my judgment, she's happier if she remains as she is, that is, single. I think I have the Spirit of God, so he's giving his opinion that probably that widow is going to be happier if she devotes herself. Now, I think of Elaine Stedman. Ray has been dead for 25 years. Elaine has been pouring her... Elaine was very shy when Ray was alive. She was always behind the scenes. She never spoke up. She thought it was her place to take care of four daughters and to not ever speak out. One of the best messages I've ever heard is her message when she was brought down for the 50th anniversary of Body Life, I think it was. And she gave a message called Body Language, which is absolutely spine-chilling in its beauty. It's on the website. You can find it. Body Language. And she was so shy, so polite and so sweet. She was always very sweet. When she died, she went through a very hard time because she had always felt that she could never, ever be an effective Christian the way Ray had been. Now she's had 25 years of pouring out her heart to her daughters, to their husbands, to the children, to grandchildren. She's got a ministry in Medford, Oregon. She's 95 today, and that woman is incredible. I have visited her several times, and I always take some maverick with me, which I don't think, Elaine couldn't be very impressed with the kids I've taken up there, but they're all good Christians now. And I know that's because Elaine prayed.
Pretty good track record.
I stayed in her home several times. I even drew, she had a home in Grants Pass, Oregon, and I put a sign up on the roof, sent her a picture of Elaine's tavern or something. I put it on a picture on the roof. Elaine had this tavern for strangers traveling through town.
Wow.
And she did, because she had an upstairs bedroom in that house, and so I was always in that bedroom, and if I brought somebody along, there was an adjacent bedroom upstairs. She had breakfast on the table every morning. She was serving. She was interested in everybody I brought up. She was interested in me. She still is. Her voice is gone, so she can't talk except in a whisper. That's been so for quite a few years. So you can't call her on the phone. When I went up there, I used to get her computer cleaned up so that she could, because she put files all over the Macintosh screen. So I helped her a lot, but what a dear, godly woman. So I think when I think of Ray Stedman, I think of Elaine, who's had 25 years of being a very godly, very relational. Ray was not very relational. He was not very good with one-on-one, brother-to-brother, because of his own childhood, because his mother threw him out of the house when he was 11. He had never had a home life.
There's that baggage thing.
He had a tremendous amount of baggage. So, anyway, that's my comments on this chapter. So, I'm talking too much.
Well, it's only 5 o'clock. Shall we read chapter 8? It's literally one column long.
Yeah, because the subject changes, but it's chapter 8 short. We've got some...
About 2 Corinthians, or which one?
First Corinthians. Chapter 8 and 9 are kind of side. So we could actually almost finish those, because it gets real heavy again in chapter 10 and onward. So go ahead.
1 Corinthians chapter 8. Now concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. And if anyone thinks that he knows anything, he knows nothing yet as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, this one is known by him. Therefore, concerning the eating of things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is no other God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, of whom all things, of whom are all things, and we for him. And one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through him we live. However, there is not in everyone that knowledge, for some with consciousness of the idol. Until now eat it as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. But food does not commend us to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, nor if we do not eat are we the worse. But beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died. But when you thus sin against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never again eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble.
We do not today get much meaning out of this, but if we think about it, we can get the meaning out of it. But in the first century in the Roman Empire, if you went to the meat market and bought a roast or some steak or some hamburger, it was probably, if you knew the history of that meat, it had been dedicated in an idolatrous temple. Mm-hmm. Before it came to the meat market. So the meat supplier was probably in charge of a temple where false gods were openly worshipped. So the meat would come into town and it would go to the temple, and the priests in the temple would pray over it and consecrate it to their demon god, and then the meat would go to the meat sales department. And so the ordinary housewife, yeah, or person going to the meat market might very well get some meat that had previously been offered to idols.
We can get a lot out of it. I mean, what we get out of it is that we don't do anything to make our brother stumble.
That's right. Howard, why don't you comment? Because that's okay, exactly
if
right.
We're doing some kind of sin, or we're doing something and it's like a bad influence on our brother, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Absolutely.
We're not doing right, you know, because we're not doing right by our brother because we're doing something and we're encouraging him to stumble, you know what I mean?
I remember
helping him to stumble by doing bad things ourselves, you know what I mean?
I remember being in Copenhagen.
That's the bottom line of this.
Ray Sedman and I were in Copenhagen once, long years ago. And Copenhagen in Germany, everybody drinks a beer, or everybody has wine with dinner. And I remember going into this restaurant, and Ray ordered a beer. And he talked about how he did not want to cause anybody to stumble, but on the other hand, he didn't want to squelch his own freedom. And he had freedom to have a glass of beer in the right circumstances, not with ex-alcoholics. And the same way with a glass of wine. Did he have wine with dinner? Yeah, occasionally. But he never got drunk. He never got tipsy. Yeah. And so in our culture today, there is a lot of legalism rampant. Right, Howard?
Yes.
Well, tell us more.
Yeah, there's a lot of legalism. You said it perfectly.
Well,
legalism, everyone's got their rules and this and that.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes it's more about they're more about the letter of the law than the spirit of the law, you know.
What if you decide that you're going
to
be...
It's like they're waiting for you to stumble, you know, they're just waiting, they get some kind of, like, pleasure in seeing their brother stumble, you know what I mean? Or that's what I feel. I mean,
that's right.
Not everybody, but, you know, there's some kind of, like, you know, evilness inside people. They like to see their brother stumble, or they want to, you know. I mean, we like to see on the news, like, oh, so-and-so failed, you know. You know.
We're like vultures.
Yeah, or something. You know what I mean? I mean, that's what I see. I mean, I'm sorry.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
I'm not saying everybody's like that, but sometimes there's something inside of us sometimes, you know.
Self-righteous.
We want to see somebody fail. Like, you know, maybe the brothers at the home want to see me fail, you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
Like, yeah. Or, you know, when somebody relapses, you know, they're like, oh, yeah, and so-and-so relapsed. You know, well, that's not the right, you know, you're
that's
laughing.
Exactly.
You act like you're, like, you know, happy about it or something, almost, you know.
Right on.
And we should be, like, you know, feeling
the
sad.
The point of this chapter here, though, is talking about, well, let's say it's somebody like Ray Steadman, who was never had an issue with alcohol, I assume. And so, you know, he was able to drink on a limited basis and you know, just for the enjoyment of having it, you know, with some good food.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, somebody who's struggling with alcoholism,
you wouldn't do that.
Because their motive is different. When they get around alcohol, you know, it's a way to make, you know, sort of self-medicate yourself from other problems that you have going on, and it's not a healthy thing. So I think the point of this is it's saying, if you're somebody that doesn't have an issue with alcohol, but you're in the company of somebody who does have an issue with it, then it's just, you know,
you don't
common
want to give
courtesy
permission.
And good wise consideration to you know,
abstain,
withhold the, you know, the drinking of alcohol around such persons, so that you're not making their struggle worse.
Yes, absolutely.
And maybe even causing them to relapse or something.
Absolutely right. Yeah. Now, would you say that there are, that you know, Christians who are very uptight about anything? Like, I don't go to the movies because the movies are bad.
Or dancing or something.
We don't. Yeah. There used to be a dancing, and then there was the issue about women's skirts. And I remember how that women should never wear skirts to church. They have to wear long pants, like men do. And then the whole thing in Corinthians about women sort of... there was a... Ray told the story of a former nightclub singer who became a Christian. And she was a very good singer, so that somebody had her come and sing at their church. And she showed up in a kind of a flimsy outfit. And they were shocked and hurt her badly, by not realizing that she was pouring her heart out to Jesus while she was singing to the church, but she got dumped on and hurt very badly by the criticism of this self-righteous church. So the self-righteous prudes that are very sensitive about all these things are self-righteous, usually. They may not even know the Lord, except in a very legalistic way, right?
Yeah, and that's it. They're being very over legalistic. I mean, to the point where
hyper-legalistic. They're
more concerned about the keeping the doctrine than they are about preserving the faith of another person.
Absolutely right. That's right, exactly. Okay. Does this make sense?
Oh, yeah. Another example that I was thinking of was, like, women will tend to dress very provocative in a sense that they are trying to find someone that is interested in them. Maybe they'll go to a bar or something like that. And maybe a Christian will be a friend that will be going with a group of people. So she shouldn't be dressing like that, and this other guy might actually be married. So you don't want to tempt him to start looking at her, that kind of thing. She needs to be thinking about him.
We men are very sensitive and vulnerable by sight. We look at a girl and our imagination runs wild. Women tend to not be sensitive to sight, but if they stop, they could be provocative without even knowing it. But a woman is much more sensitive to motivations and to real love and real affirmation. And women don't ordinarily run around and lust the way men do. They do, but a good wife realizes that her husband is vulnerable to pornography.
The proponents of the purveyors of pornography in the culture have gotten very... very good at finding ways to
lure you in.
Well, I was specifically thinking about women. I mean, what you said is correct, you know, just naturally, but they're going out of their way to hook women in, you know, to forms of pornography.
Oh, gosh.
And tailoring it to their, you know, to their likings and stuff, so that they get drug into that kind of stuff too. The culture is really evil that way anymore.
It's very evil, and women are oftentimes exploited to deal with male lust. It's not about love at all. It's about knowing where men are vulnerable and seducing them. It's what prostitutes are good at.
Manipulation.
Manipulate. And getting a man all turned on and hooked and drawn into this demonic realm. So, and the society is wretched. You see this every day, Howard, I think.
The word.
In your brothers.
I guess. Man, I don't know.
Lambert, did you want to read chapter 9?
What's that?
Did you want to read chapter 9?
Sure.
Go ahead.
I get to read it?
Yeah.
Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are not you my workmanship in the Lord? If to others I am not an apostle, at least I am to you. For you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. This is my defense to those who would examine me. Do we not have the right to food and drink? Do we not have the right to be accompanied by a wife, as the other apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas, Peter? Peter was married. Or is it only Barnabas and I? Barnabas is single and young guy. And is it only Barnabas and I have no right to refrain from working for a living? You don't even want us having secular jobs to support ourselves so we can teach all the time, but we got to have money coming in. Is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working for a living? Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? If you join the army's going to feed you and give you a uniform and train you and protect you as much as possible. Who plants a vineyard without eating any of its fruit? You wouldn't have a vineyard unless you could have some grapes or some wine or get paid for selling the grapes. Who tends a flock without getting some of the milk? You have a bunch of cows and they get milked every day. Well, of course the dairy owner would get some of the milk and the cheese and whatever, no matter how it's done. Do I say this on human authority? Does not the law say the same? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox when it is treading out the grain. Is it for oxen that God is concerned? Does God care more about the cow, the donkey, and the oxen that pulls the plow, and the hired hands? Does he care more about the animals? No. Is it for oxen that God is concerned? Does he not speak entirely for our sake? It was written for our sake because the plowman should plow in hope. Hope and get paid. And that the thresher should thresh in hope of a share in the crop. So the farmhands should get paid or get paid in kind. You get take a goat home or a jug of milk or some cheese or whatever. The plowman should plow in hope and the thresherman should hope of a share in the crop. If we've sown spiritual good among you, is it too much if we reap material benefits? In other words, a man who's busy teaching and preaching has a right to be supported by the people he's serving because he doesn't have time to go make tents ordinarily, or he doesn't have time to hold down a job, or the people around him have said, look, we'll support you so that you're free to teach and travel, because if you're doing us so much good spiritually. If others share this rightful claim upon you, do we not still more? So even the fake false teachers are supported by their audience. We got churches now of 20,000 people, and the money coming in amounts to millions. And of course, in many cases, the pastor getting paid way more than is proper because he gets a big house and a car and a helicopter and a plane and so on. Nevertheless, we have not made use of this right. We endure everything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who are employed in the temple service get their food from the temple? That's Old Testament, the Jewish temple. The priests serving all day long could take some of the food from the offerings home and for themselves and their families. They were married most of the time. In the same way, the Lord commanded that those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. So that's a pretty strong... we have an obligation to support the godly teachers that we know at church. But we don't have an obligation to support the bad teachers and the crackpots and the jerks, so we can give some money to a foreign mission or something that we believe in, whatever. Paul says, I have made no use of any of these rights, nor am I writing this to secure any such provision. I don't want you guys coming to me after that talk, and I'm not going to take up an offering, and I'm not asking for support, because right now I'm making a bunch of tents. I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of my ground for boasting. I'm self-supporting, I make tents, I work long hours, and I'm not about to be a charity case or a basket case at all. So, for if I preach the gospel, that gives me no ground for boasting. Necessity is laid upon me. I'm compelled to preach the gospel. This isn't something that's my hobby, or this is my life, Paul says. I don't do this of my own will. I have a reward. But if not of my own will, I am entrusted with the commission. So I feel obligated to finish the job that God has given me, whether I get paid for it or not. What then is my reward? Just this, that in my preaching, I make the gospel free of charge, not making full use of my right in the gospel. And I take that to be apply to ministries that charge you a fortune for their books and their records and their stuff, even if it's good. I really feel like if you're serving the Lord, you don't have to worry about copyrights necessarily. You can. But there's so many good books that I would like to read, but I got to spend money. The best resources ought to be free. And that's what the Apostle Paul was never putting any obligation on anybody to support him. He makes the gospel free of charge, not making partial use of my right in the gospel. So he's got a right, but he's never going to talk about it, and he's never going to complain if he has to go make tents. Though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, that I might win the more. To the Jews, I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law, I became as one under the law, though not myself being under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, not being without law toward God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. Do you not know that in a race all runners compete, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable crown, but we an imperishable. Well, I don't run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I pummel my body and subdue it, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. That's pretty powerful stuff. And the part in here that really strikes me is that when we talk to an audience, maybe it's a stranger on the street and you're evangelizing, maybe it's a group of ladies at a Bible class, maybe it's a group of men, maybe it's at the brother's house. You got to cater what you say. You don't yell and shout and scream and jump up and down and get everybody all freaked out. You adjust to the listeners. If you're in a group of alcoholics, maybe you can say, well, I was an alcoholic once, or I've never had a problem with alcohol, but I know about a whole bunch of other sins. So you want to, Paul is accommodating himself. He's what he says is geared to the audience that he's speaking to. We've already seen that in Corinthians because of all of the temptations to immorality in Corinth and how Paul spoke to that issue, but gently and lovingly and most and so sensitively. So you don't want to lord it over your audience, no matter. Even if it's just one friend or one group or the brother's house, you want to be sensitive to the fact that the people you're talking to have a unique situation, make me ex-alcoholics, ex-drug addicts, ex-cons. You want to be identify with those people and not be authoritative and lord it over them, because that really turns people off when you're that. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that's this chapter. Now, Dave, you asked me to read it. Could you just summarize this for us? No, you can't.
I got a question. Wasn't Paul a basket case in one instance where they let him down in a basket to help him escape
on the road to Damascus? Here's this Jew persecuting Christians, and he goes to Damascus. He hears some Christians in Damascus, and he's going to go hunt them down, haul them back to Jerusalem, and probably kill them or torture them or put them in jail. It's on the road to Damascus, which is north of Jerusalem a little ways, not very far. And the Lord comes to him in a blinding light and says, "Paul, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And Saul knew immediately that this was Jesus, that he'd been killing and persecuting and hounding these Christians. And
he says, "Why do you kick against the goat or whatever?"
It's very hard for you to kick against the goat. It's an ox goat.
Yeah, that's like a thing. Yeah, it's like
you're fighting against.
Didn't he ask him at the beginning? He said, when.
Why are you kicking against?
He said he tries to fight against it. You know, they'll spear him when he kicks back. Or
yeah, yeah.
First thing he reacted to being knocked off his horse, you know, by the blinding light and everything.
Who are you?
To say, "Who are you, Lord?"
Yeah.
So did he really know who Jesus was at that point?
Pretty soon, because he's struck blind. He can't see, and they continue to Damascus, and there are some Christians with him.
They didn't see it, though. They didn't see what he saw, though.
No, I don't think so.
I mean, sheer power would have told him that it's the Lord, but
yeah. Well,
he was saying, "Who are you, Lord?" Which seems like a reasonable question for a Jewish person to ask, you know?
Because yeah, so he's put in the care.
Well, he knew it was something powerful. He knew it was something powerful.
But he can't see, and he's blind, and he's confused, and he's put in the care of some Christians in Damascus.
Yeah,
he's not put in the Roman camp, in the Pharisees' camp. He's taken to this brother in the Lord, and of course the Christians in Damascus are going to have heard about Paul, and they're terrified that he's coming to kill them. But this one brother there shows him all about Jesus and explains to him his vision. And then when the Pharisees get news of this, they're ready to kill him. And so the believers lower him in a basket out the window, and he flees for some time off to Saudi Arabia. So he escaped from death, but this is the point where his whole life turns around inside out.
So that was a tongue-in-cheek question about the basket case, but
he's a basket case.
For a few seconds there, he was some sort of a basket case.
For 3 days, and then he got his vision back.
Yeah. No, but I mean, just
literally
lowered down in the basket to help escape the people that were out to do him.
So that's in Acts, and this is a thrilling story.
In Acts chapter 9, verse 5, it says, "And he said, 'Who are you, Lord?'"
Yeah.
So it seems like he was recognizing that God was in his presence right there, and he was asking,
"That's great. Yeah.
Are you Jehovah or are you Jesus?" And Jesus says,
"Yeah, that's kind of along the lines."
The Lord said, "I am Jesus."
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was revealing that you were wrong, that Jehovah is not who I am, but I am Jesus.
And in fact, you did reject your Messiah.
Thank you, Dave. That's very helpful. But that really is good. I just love Dave's understanding and knowledge of the Bible, because it's so good.
Well, he has good teachers too.
I mean, he goes around.
Besides you,
well,
the guy,
I'm trying to undo all the damage I've done.
You still go to those Bible studies, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm going in a few minutes.
You got one tonight?
Mm-hmm. So
he's going to Bible study fellowship tonight. So this man here is going to end up an awesome teacher. Awesome.
No, not a teacher.
Well, he whips out those scriptures pretty quick now.
Oh, he knows the Bible.
Who needs a concordance when you're hanging around?
When you've got Dave around, yeah.
That's what your iPhone is
for. Works for me.
Anyway.